So one of the, I think, very interesting questions, never-ending questions, is how do you respond if things don't go the way you want them to go? Now, the first Buddhist response to that question is to change the question from if to when. Because in Buddhism, the assumption is that things are not going to go the way we want them to go. That's, you know, not all the time, but it's kind of built into human life, to this reality of ours, that things are not going to go the way they should, or we want them to, or according to the ideal, that things are somehow going to go in an unsatisfactory way. And for people who really kind of understand this, it can, rather than being a depressing fact, can bring on a kind of a lightness of being, that we're built into our engagement with life, our walking through life, is a recognition, understanding that the unexpected is going to happen, and the unexpected sometimes is not going to be what we had in mind, how things should go. So for a Buddhist, ideally, for a Buddhist, they're never taken by surprise when things don't go the way they should. I mean, to some degree it's a surprise. I mean, all kinds of things can happen. There's light things, small things can happen, and really big things can happen that, in some sense you could say shouldn't be this way, shouldn't be that way. One response, of course, is to be really angry. This is, shouldn't be this way. This. Another response is to run away. Another response is blame oneself. And things like being angry, running away, blaming oneself, being angry towards oneself, would be examples of adding suffering on top of suffering, but adding suffering to our situation. And so what's the wise ways we can approach life when we know that sooner or later things are going to happen that are different than what we hoped that they would happen, or we wished they'd happen, or our ideas of what they should happen? So that's I said in the beginning, a never-ending question. What do we do when things are not going the way they should? Buddhism has a lot of ideals. Religious traditions often have a lot of ideals. And those ideals can be oppressive. Buddhist ideals can be quite oppressive if you take them on as this is the way it should be. I should be compassionate. That's a good Buddhist ideal, right? Some of you are inspired by the idea of compassionate. This is how you should respond. You should be able to, beatifically respond with great compassion to your family over the holidays. And you're all set to do it. And then come New Year's, you realize you have to make a resolution. I think I need to make some effort. Mm-hmm. But it can be quite painful to have an idea like, I'm going to be compassionate, and then not live up to it. More painful than it was not to have that, perhaps. Or to be peaceful, or to be ideal to be kind, or idea to be free from it, not get caught by the situation. Something situation you keep getting caught with over and over again. I'm not going to get caught. Not going to get angry. There's a lot of ideals. And what I'd like to propose is that one of the very mature ways of responding to relating to ideals in the Buddhist sense is not to go after the ideal directly, but to focus on what is it that stands in the way of the ideal. What's your obstacle to the ideal? So if being compassionate is your ideal, what is it that prevents you from being compassionate? Now, when you look at that, maybe it's not so-called good news. Maybe you get angry a lot, or maybe you're bitter, or maybe you're resentful, or maybe you're easily offended. All kinds of things that might happen make difficult for compassion to be there. Maybe you're distracted a lot. You're not really paying attention, so it's hard to be compassionate if you're in fantasy land. The idea is to look at that and use the mindfulness, use the presence of mindfulness to investigate and really understand what the obstacle is. And for some people, that's counterintuitive, because some people, the obstacles are embarrassing. The obstacles are the problem, and you're not supposed to have a problem. The obstacle is a thing that shouldn't be happening. And so it shouldn't be happening, right? So some people are in a hurry to get rid of them. Some people want to deny them. Some people, you know, get angry to the obstacles, all kinds of things. But one approach to a Buddhist life is to, in a sense, be welcoming to the obstacles. Not there as a cheerleader cheering them on, go for it. But in the sense of being really interested in them, understanding them. Because if you understand them well, chances are they're going to be less of an obstacle. The more clearly you can know an obstacle, the less power it has over you. That's the argument here. I don't know if it's always true, but that's, you know, often can be the case. So the idea is to be welcoming in the sense, oh, I'm resentful. I'm overwhelmed. Let me understand this phenomenon of resentment or overwhelm as best I can. And then you can kind of consider what are the various ways you have to understand this phenomenon. Sometimes it's useful to just stop in your tracks, take a break, say, excuse me, I have to go for a walk, and actually spend some time with yourself reflecting, what just happened? What was going on there? Sometimes it's helpful to, at the end of the day, to kind of sit back and kind of just in the quiet time of day also reflect and think. Sometimes it's helpful to actually find a friend and say, you know, can we go for a walk and talk about this issue that I have? You know, I keep getting resentful, and you know, I've looked at it, I've thought about it a lot, but it keeps coming up. Maybe if you ask me some questions, or I can just bounce ideas off you, maybe I can get some more clarity around what's going on for me. Or perhaps some people like to go to therapy. There's a place to explore certain issues, and they find it helpful in that kind of, or a spiritual counselor or something. Meditation is an interesting place to look at these things. If something like resentment or overwhelm arises, to sit down and meditate as a way of having a much higher magnifying glass to study it, to really be present for it, to open up to it inside, like from the inside out. And that requires a lot of willingness to be present for discomfort. And some people say, you know, that's not supposed to be happening. Right? It's a theme today, right? It's not supposed to be happening. So if it's not supposed to be happening, then we pull back or we push it away or something. But the idea is to be welcoming. Say, okay, I'm going to open up to what's really happening and be really present for it. What would it be like to sit down, close my eyes, take the one seat, take the seat here, and really allow myself to feel as fully as I can what maybe I've never allowed myself to feel before. I've never taken really careful time to take it in, to be present for it. And then you might be in for a wild ride. Because all kinds of things might happen as you really start taking in, really start being present for some of the tremendous forces in the mind and the heart that goes on. Some of our fear and anger and judgments and criticisms and all kinds of stuff that goes on there. There's a kind of cliche which I think when I first heard it, I thought it was funny, and sometimes I don't like it. But the cliche, which is also not always true, but the cliche is self-knowledge is seldom good news. So the willingness to kind of open up to that self-knowledge that maybe is not good news, to see it. So part of Buddhist spirituality I'd like to offer is just a willingness to enter into the very thing that stands in our way from what we want to see happen. And as we understand that much more deeply, then it's less likely to invite us. I've seen myself often enough where I've bypassed the obstacle and held on in some artificial way to the ideal. I'm going to be compassionate here. I'm not going to be angry. A few weeks ago, my eight-year-old son, I said to my eight-year-old son, thinking, trying to find always new strategies, right, to figure out how to deal with these kids. Kids, you know, it's just not the way it should be. All the time. One constant, one continuous. This is not the way it's supposed to be. He was beginning to act in ways that he shouldn't act, right? According to what? According to me. And I didn't want to get angry because, you know, I've learned that being angry isn't always a very good strategy at home. But you need to do something to set limits. So I thought, oh, I'll just say to him calmly, warn him. If this behavior continues, you know, I'm going to get angry. Just, I thought the warning might kind of... And so I said that to him. And he looked at me with a big smile and said, Dad, you're already angry. Busted. No, then I wasn't angry anymore. That was enough. So there's something very mature, I believe, about stopping and taking a look at the obstacles. So I've seen holding on to the ideal has come back and bitten me. You know, I was trying to be a certain way. And then not paying attention and noticing the buildup of resentment or anger or grumpiness or something like that. And so, you know, and then it gets out of hand at some point. But actually to kind of have a habit of keeping an eye out, what is the obstacle? What's the difficulty here? I think that it's a much more realistic way of dealing with the ideal. And one of the amazing things, what beautiful things can happen, is that once you deal with the obstacle, maybe it settles away, maybe a different wonderful thing happens rather than what you had hoped for. So it might be that what you wanted was compassion. Or say what you want is concentration. That's an ideal, right? Meditators want to get concentrated. And, you know, I've tried to get concentrated by, you know, just holding on to that concentrated state. You know, right? And it just doesn't work that way for me. And but sometimes if I look at what are the obstacles to getting concentrated, then it takes a while, but I look at them and be present for them and concentrate on those. It's kind of like Aikido. You concentrate on the thing that makes it difficult to concentrate. And then it settles away. And then sometimes I find myself then concentrated. If the obstacles are not there, it's almost like a natural state to get concentrated. It's like what's left. But sometimes it's open to something else. Sometimes it's open to states of loving kindness. Beautiful states of loving kindness. And I've been so appreciating that state of kindness. You don't know what's going to open up necessarily when the obstacles drop away. And so sometimes holding on to an ideal, again, prevents something else maybe that's more beautiful or more appropriate to happen. Here's a little story from this weekend. Not a good example, but it just comes to mind of Friday evening, I went out for dinner with some friends. I was going to go out for dinner with two friends. And one of them didn't show up. So we left anyway to go down the street here to go to the restaurant. And eventually he calls and says that he's in car trouble. But so I'm going to make it anyway, even though I can't seem to start my car. I'll come anyway to dinner. And we'll deal with the not starting car once we finish dinner. So three of us went out after dinner to the parking lot, and in fact he couldn't start his car. And none of us had jumper cables. So, you know, this wasn't supposed to be happening. And it was really cold Friday night. We were standing in the parking lot freezing. And so I came back here to get my car, because it was here, we'd walked. And when I came back, this tow truck pulled into the parking lot. And they had gone down to the Safeway parking lot to do something, to look at the Longs, see if Longs had cables. And there, in the front of Starbucks there, they ran into a tow truck guy. And he said, oh, come. And he was just this lovely guy. And here we had this problem. It shouldn't be, right? The car should work. But for me, I was so delighted to meet this wonderful tow truck guy who showed up. You know, he was so warm and so generous. And as far as I know, he didn't ask for any payment. It was just like, here, I'll do it. You're in trouble. It was really easy for him. He had his little battery pack. So it's a little, maybe a little teeny example of how when something doesn't go the way it should, can it open up to something else that maybe that's really beautiful or nice? When we did the beginning of the chaplaincy training program this year, we went around the room. People talked about their experience of receiving spiritual care from someone, like where they're hospitalized and hospital chaplain came to talk to them or something. And one of the things, one of the highlights of going around was how many of the people who decided to become Buddhist chaplains had been inspired by the care that someone gave them when they were sick. It changed their life. You know, they had to move in a whole different direction. They shouldn't have been sick, right? That's not true. People shouldn't get sick in human life. That's not the way life should be, right? It's a mistake to get sick. It's a personal mistake, right? It's a personal fault that you get sick. That's the way some people relate to it. But it's built into human life to get sick, and what happens. And as unfortunate as it is, what does it open up to? Does it open up to something that maybe wouldn't have happened if you weren't? So you never know what will come out. What I found out is being present is the doorway for the unexpected, wonderful things to happen. And I never quite know what's going to happen or what should happen, but being present for what is. And being present for what is a different strategy than running away. It's a different strategy than shutting down. It's a different strategy than blaming and attacking. It's also a different strategy than trying to fix. Let's fix it. Better than just, okay, I'm going to be present here. Let's see what's going on. Let's look at the obstacles, let's look at the ideals, let's look at what my mind does. So there are five different things I can think of that can be helpful in this process of investigating the obstacles. And each of these five things, give us a certain kind of personal, maybe that was the best word, language, but kind of personal power or strength in situations that often we feel like we're undermined. The first is, it's really helpful to have some confidence or faith in yourself, in a practice, in an approach. So just the idea that you have confidence in the idea that life is often unsatisfactory, that things don't happen the way that they're supposed to happen. There's a way in which that can give you some kind of faith or confidence that so that you're not overwhelmed or criticized or see that this is a terrible mistake. There's a saying in Japan that a Zen Master Dogen said, a Zen master's life is one continuous mistake. That's very, very helpful for me. Think of that. One continuous mistake. So to have faith, in Buddhism we say it's the faith in the three characteristics, but the faith in one of the characteristics of human life is that it is unsatisfactory. There's an unsatisfactory element to it. That doesn't mean that there isn't beautiful aspects to it, but have faith that have some confidence in that things change and unfold and take all kinds of directions. There's confidence and faith in having a practice, like mindfulness practice. There's confidence and faith to know that there are other people who've worked through these kinds of things, and that the very things that we call our obstacles can become our doors to liberation, doors to compassion, doors to love, doors to forgiveness, doors to kindness. There's faith, so faith in other people who've gone through these kinds of things. Sometimes it's very helpful. We had a chaplaincy program on Friday. We had a discussion about suicide. And one of the members there was quite emotionally disturbed by this because of suicide of a parent many years ago. And needed to actually take some time off out of the meeting just to kind of deal with it and be present for it and be alone with it for a while. It's quite a big, powerful thing to happen. But as part of the way of processing this, one of the teachers in the program asked how many people in the room had experienced the suicide of a family member or a close friend. And the majority of the hands went up. And I think it just changed the whole kind of understanding of what we were doing there in the room when we saw what a common experience it was to have that kind of tragedy happen. So to realize other people have gone through this is very helpful. So some kind of faith, some kind of confidence, something we trust, something we are willing to kind of... Faith doesn't do a lot. Faith is not a practice. Faith is not a doing. But just to know you have faith, to say faith that it's useful to pay attention to the obstacles. faith that it's useful to stop and look at this stuff is a very, very helpful thing. So what's your faith? Do you have faith? Do you have what do you have confidence in? And sometimes it's helpful to actually cultivate something you have confidence in preparation for difficult times. The second is engagement. It's really helpful to engage your difficulties. Now, there are many different ways of engaging your difficulties, not just one. So engagement doesn't always mean you kind of run full steam ahead and dive into it. But engagement means that you arouse some kind of effort to do something in relationship to it. It could be that you go for a walk with a friend. It could be that you stop and meditate. It could be that you go take a shower until you can cool off. It could be that you journal about the situation. It could be that you say the truth. You tell someone, you know, I'm really stressed out right now, as opposed to pretending you're not, so they can participate in understanding what your situation is. But actually to have feel like I'm going to engage the situation, I'm going to do something. I'm not going to be the victim of this. I'm going to be someone who actually engages it. And to have a victim mode and kind of give up is not very helpful. So somehow to engage it. Now, one of the ways to engage it is to do nothing. Doing nothing, not in the sense of giving up, but doing nothing and then being very awake, very present for it. So, you know, not trying to fix it, not trying to run away, but rather, okay, this is going on. I don't know what's supposed to happen here, but I'm going to not do anything. And in that not doing anything, I'm going to try to really make space to understand or to see or be present or to feel what's going on. Doing nothing in that spirit can be very, very powerful. I've done it many, many times and amazed at what new information, what new unfolding happens when I stay present, try to be as honest as I can in what's going on, but don't do anything. Because sometimes I have a fix-it tendency, you know, and sometimes that's not very helpful. It doesn't allow for something deeper to happen. And then part of this, one of the things to do, it's maybe can be related to doing nothing, is to be mindful. To bring mindful to the situation. And there have been times where I've kind of had a faith, one of my faith, one of the things I trust, is that the present moment, my present moment experience, is trustable if I can be mindful of it. My present moment experience is not trustable if I'm not mindful of it. And over and over and over again, I found that if I'm really mindful for things, maybe not, you know, the truck barreling down on the road, you know, just be mindful, but there are certain things we have to kind of do and get out of the way of or fix, but over and over again in my inner life, in my interpersonal life with people, I found that the situation is amazingly trustable if what I try to do is to be mindful. And one of the very interesting ways of being mindful is to do it out loud. So it's kind of, it can be similar to the process of making I statements. You know, just say, this is what I'm experiencing now. This is what I'm experiencing right now. Or right now, I'm frustrated. And then kind of that allows people to have more information. They can participate in kind of clarifying the situation. But to bring mindfulness is to study the situation. Try to understand it deeper, more carefully. To study what your beliefs are, your thoughts, your feelings, your mind, your body, your intuition. Kind of, okay, stop and pay attention here. Be mindful of the situation around you. What's going on here in this room? What's happening here with these people who are doing all this stuff? What's going on at this, you know, holiday party? What's really going on here? And you look around and say, oh, you know, first person over there is really anxious. That person over there feels really awkward and is pulling away. That person over there is angry. That person over there is sad. And, oh, now I didn't realize it was so complex, all these people here. I thought it was all about me. And that changes the information. Then you kind of relate to it differently. So mindfulness. The other thing that can be very helpful is to try to get calm. Now, calm isn't ideal, and so sometimes you want to study how you're not calm, but sometimes it's possible to calm yourself a little bit, to get a little more focused or calm or settled. And sometimes just breathing deeply. My son yesterday, he went to the school fair at his school yesterday, and he had a wild time with all his friends. He was just like running around like crazy. And it was time to go home, but he wanted to do one more thing, to check on something. And my wife said, and he was kind of like wild. And so my wife said, okay, you can do it, but only if you orient yourself first. He said, okay. So you went like this. And then he wasn't wild. He's 8 years old. Can you do that? Take a deep breath. I didn't teach him this, by the way. I probably couldn't. But he's learned how to, what he calls, orient himself, and he takes a deep breath and closes his eyes and gets centered. And then his wildness sometimes goes away. So to calm yourself, and have the skills and ability to bring some kind of calm. Breathing, just breathing deeply can be helpful. Taking a deep breath and having a long exhale and just kind of letting yourself settle in the exhale can be helpful. And other ways, what other ways do you have to calm yourself? I'm embarrassed by the number of times where I've been agitated by something and then acted through my agitation, with my agitation, only to realize the situation was different. And, you know, occasionally I had the experience of actually saying, I'm not going to act on this. I'm agitated. Maybe I better calm first. And then I find some way to calm down, and then I go back into the situation and I realize the situation is different than what I thought. And it's a kind of an attitude I have, policy approach I have to being angry, is I'll try my best not to act when I'm angry, but I'll try to somehow dissipate the anger. But then when the anger is dissipated, not to then avoid the situation, but then to go back into the difficult situation and try to deal with it when I'm not angry. And so somehow to calm ourselves is another approach. And the and then another approach is to use our not only our mindfulness situation, but to use our intelligence. Try to understand it better. Think about it. Think about it together with some friends. Think it out. Try to understand what's really going on. Try to investigate in a deeper way. Try to understand the causal connections, the causal nexus that kind of brings these things into place. Try to understand. What is it? How would it be useful to respond? What are the various choices you have in how to respond to the situation? Mindfulness doesn't teach you how to respond. It's your intelligence which will do that. So to engage your intelligence, you know, what can be done here? What are different ways? What's the solutions? And then the overarching ideal, which maybe can inspire you, even though it's difficult to have, is whenever you find yourself in a situation that's difficult for you, painful and suffering, is where is the compassion? Can there be some compassion in the situation? Compassion toward yourself, compassion to others. And I've seen some situations where compassion was the great jewel that the situation gave birth to. And that was the only thing that was needed, was the compassion. And sometimes the only thing that's possible in some situations, compassionate presence. It's a beautiful thing. So have the ability to be compassionate for yourself. Do you have that ability? If you don't have that ability, what can you do to find out how to do it? If you don't have the ability to be compassionate for yourself, what is the obstacle to it? So how do you relate to life when things are happening that shouldn't be happening? How do you relate to it? That is your assignment for this next week, in your next life. And to look at all the different aspects of that. And each different people have different strategic ways. Some people are more the running away type. Some are more the attacking type. Some people, you know, all kinds of ways. But what's your way? What's your way of responding to things when they're going the way they're not supposed to? How do you respond when there's no wisdom? And how can you respond when you do have wisdom? And when you do have wisdom, perhaps these five things can be helpful to think about. Faith, engagement, mindfulness, calm, and intelligence. All of us are apprenticed to the same teacher that the religious institutions originally worked with, namely, reality. Reality insight says, master the 24 hours. Do it well, without self-pity. It is as hard to get the children herded into the carpool and down the road to the bus as it is to chant sutras in the Buddha hall on a cold morning. One move is not better than the other. Each can be quite boring. They both have the virtuous quality of repetition. Repetition and ritual and their good results come in many forms. Changing the filter, wiping noses, going to meetings, picking up around the house, washing dishes, checking the dipstick. Don't let yourself think these are distracting you from your more serious pursuits. Such a round of chores is not a set of difficulties we hope to escape from, so that we may do our practice, which will put us on a path. It is our path. Gary Snyder. So, we have a little bit of time. If anybody has any comments or questions? Anybody felt that this talk wasn't the way it's supposed to be? Please. Right behind you.
How's that? My name is Sean. I think one of the things that helps me is recognizing expectations. Someone once told me that expectations are just premeditated resentments. So whenever I realize that I'm entering those situations expecting something to happen, then I know I'm probably not going to be present. So anyway, that's one of my indicators. If I have expectations, then I have an obstacle, and I need to work on that.
Great. Thank you. What's the difference between expectation and anticipation? I anticipate that the traffic lights will work on El Camino, but I don't expect them to.
And there's a level of control that one has. So with expectations, you have the expectation you have a little more control in the situation, whereas anticipation, you acknowledge that you really don't have control over the situation.
So the difference is between the amount of control you have over it, with anticipation. The suggestion is that maybe you realize you don't have control, or absolute control, whereas expectation is the idea that you have some control over it.
Mm-hmm.
Anticipation is preparation?
Is that like that?
I guess it can be a kind of like preparation. I was trying to find a word. I agree with Sean about the difficulties of expectation, but it seems like it should be okay to have some foreseeing of what you might, I don't want to use the word expect now, but what you might anticipate that doesn't involve necessarily suffering because of that, right? So I can anticipate, or I can visualize what might happen, what it might be like, but I don't expect it to be that it necessarily is going to be that way, or I don't depend on it. I'm not attached to it being that way. I'm not depending on it. And I think often the way people hold expectation, it really comes back and bites them. So premeditated resentment works well.
Seems very narrow expectations.
Mm, yeah. Yeah, like, you know, yeah, we expect things to work. You go to India, you know.
Yes. There's
a flavor of curiosity and anticipation that maybe isn't there with the expectation. Anticipation is more, has more open-ended feeling to it. Yes?
Could you elaborate a little? Could you elaborate on an unexpected medical situation that become obsessive or cause unexpected suffering? How to apply your principles in that situation?
How to apply my principles? The I think I think not to be taken too much by surprise, because you know, sickness is part of human life, and don't feel like it's a personal failing, or, and it's quite unfortunate. It's quite tragic in many ways, but we never know. You know, I kind of walk around never knowing, never sure when I'm going to die, or, you know, death and sickness and. And, you know, they're just around the corner. So I often reflect on that. And so, you know, if, I don't know to what degree I would be, I'm sure I would be quite surprised and distressed if suddenly something, I received some terrible diagnosis. But, you know, at least in my mind, you know, I don't think of it so far away. It's, you know, it's possible any moment to happen. So the idea that so they have the expectation they're supposed to always be health and perfect health, their expectation is supposed to be a long life, and this is the way, what it's all about, is a setup for problems. So some of it has to do with how you prepare yourself even before, how you practice, or the wisdom you have even before the unexpected thing has arisen. And part of the function of Buddhist practice is a kind of preparation for dying, and the preparation for things, you know, that happen that shouldn't happen. And then if you have some confidence or faith in a practice or an approach, you know, that, oh, well, maybe this is unfortunate that I have this thing, but I have this faith, I have an understanding that I can approach it in a way that's wise. I can approach it in a way that may be compassionate. I can approach it in a way that's helpful. If you don't have any faith or confidence, you have an approach, then you may be at the mercy of the medical profession. They're going to help you. And I've known people who have gone into surgery and did loving kindness practice going in to surgery, and they felt that was so helpful, because until they had a meditation practice like loving kindness to do, they were kind of the passive you know, recipients, victims of the surgeon. They couldn't do anything in the situation. People were doing things to them, but they were just kind of like, you know, just kind of had to kind of be there. But once they felt they could do a meditation practice like loving kindness, being wheeled into surgery, they feel like they're kind of some of their own personal power or abilities or engagement in it. They're taking some responsibilities there. So to have a practice that allows you to take or find personal responsibility, and then to engage in it, to feel like, okay, I have this serious problem that's happening. Let me engage in it as a part of my spiritual practice. And if you're not sure how to do that, then you talk to someone about it. And then to be mindful. It's a really important time to be mindful. The more serious the illness is, the more, and from a Buddhist point of view, the more important it is to start practicing mindfulness practice, and to bring very clear mindfulness, very clear understanding, what's really going on here. Also to practice concentration practice or a calming practice, so that your mind, as long as your mind is clear enough, to have a mind that becomes stronger than your fear and your agitation, so you're not pulled away in there. So it's not uncommon, places like in Thailand, when someone comes like to a teacher there and they have a diagnosis of cancer, and the meditation teacher will tell them, now's your time to develop concentration on the breath and really kind of develop that really strong mind so you can work with this right up until the point of your death. And then use your intelligence. You know, so you're not the victim to it also. Your mind, your thoughts, your beliefs are not just kind of like your old habits kicking in, but that some new intelligence is opening new pathways of understanding so you can approach it in wiser ways. And remember, Darlene Cohen has come and taught here sometimes. The wonderful teacher has serious arthritis. And at some point thought she was dying. And her mindfulness practice skyrocketed when she took her illness seriously. She just kind of was laying in bed and had given up and wasn't making any effort at all. And her Zen teacher came to her and said, if you continue this way, you're going to die. And so that kind of rallied her forces, and she got out. And she would study things like, you know, how she would place her weight down on her knee so to minimize the amount of pain as she walked. So they're very careful. She used her intelligence to kind of learn how to walk, given all her arthritis. What could she do? How could she walk in such a way that actually not only alleviated the pain, but maybe it was a little bit healing or helpful? And so a lot of study, a lot of intelligence went into kind of understanding the engineering feat of just walking. So to use your intelligence, you know, what's needed here, what can you do? So I don't know if any of those helpful, what you're thinking about. So, see, it's now 10:48. We were supposed to stop at 10:45. Things happen the way they're not supposed to so easily. But I want to express my gratitude before we go. Thank you for sitting with us, sitting with me, and thank you for listening. And I hope that this paves the way to a smooth holiday season.